Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I'm the host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. I am so happy because Hallie Lieberman is joining me once again. She was my guest for the last show, December the 29th. And as I said in my show notes, I wanted to leave 2020 on a high note, or should we say buzz, because that's the name of her book, Buzz. It's a wonderful book, a stimulating history of the sex toy industry, and it's archived on my website, drdianawiley.com. So be sure and go back and listen to it, or PRN's archive as well. So welcome back, Hallie. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me back. I'm so happy to be back on to talk about, all things sex and gigolos and all the fun things.
Yeah. Hallie is a sex historian and journalist. And if you go to her website, Hallie Lieberman, and I'll put all of this in my show notes, but Hallie Lieberman, you'll be able to see some of the wonderful articles that she's written. And you have a book in progress, and that's going to be our focus of today, with some little sidebars, little side trips. Tell us about your book in progress.
Yeah, so I am writing a book on the history of the gigolo, which, you know, very little has been written about. And the gigolo is a male either escort or dancer who is paid to have sex with women. And gigolos have existed throughout history since the ancient Greek times. It's this fascinating phenomenon. And so that's what the book's about.
Yeah, and you go into the history of the gigolo, the male escort. The term gigolo isn't used quite as much these days, or is it? Maybe I'm not up on my gigolos enough.
Yeah, it's hard to keep up. There's so much gigolo news. Well, it's sometimes used not among people in the industry, but as a branding thing. So the Gigolos reality show on Showtime was called Gigolos. So it was used for that. So there's enough knowledge about the term for it to be used for that. But today it would be more like either male escort, male companion, things like that.
Yes. And what about the history of the gigolo? Because I think that is fascinating. You and I spoke a little bit about this off the air. And you mentioned somebody that I know. Kind of wish I knew him, but he lived a long time ago, Rudolf Valentino. And he was born on the same day I was born, May 6th. So we're birthday companions. but tell us a little bit about the history of gigolos. And it goes way back before Rudolf Valentino. So would you fill us in, please? It's such a fascinating history.
Yeah, so women have been seeking out sex, like paid sex from men, like I said, since like ancient Greek and Roman times. And there was a little bit written about how women would pay, upper class women, because they were the only women who could afford to do it, would pay gladiators to have sex with them.
Gladiators.
Yes.
The big hunks, right?
Yeah, exactly. The most desirable men. And now, so that's like the earliest recorded history we have of women doing that. Then we move up into, I'm going to fast forward a little bit to Valentino and to the early 1900s. There's a lot of interesting history in between, but gigolo becomes mainstream in the US, in Paris, in other areas of Europe, in Germany, in the early, like 1910s. And when I say gigolo this time, it was a male dancer paid to dance with women. Okay. And that's what they were paying them for. And they were called taxi dancers.
Oh yeah.
Yes, exactly. And so there were female taxi dancers as well. They were also called tango pirates, which
tango pirates.
Yes. And I love that term because they were like Valentino was the silent film star. Before he became a film star, he was a tango pirate. he was like an expert in the tango. And
but the pirate part, explain the pirate part. I sort of get an idea, but.
Yeah, well, so the I'm not entirely sure about the pirate part, but it had this negative connotation because people thought that the taxi dancers were ripping off women by you know, asking them for money for dances and things like that. And they would try to get more and more money. Like Valentino would get paid. So he came to the U.S. in 1913. He was from a small town in Italy. He struggled and finally got this job as a taxi dancer at Maxim's in New York City. He was super handsome, Italian guy, beautiful. The only kind of flaw was he had a cauliflower ear. And he had a scar on his face that people thought was a knife fight from a knife fight. And he let them think that, but really it was from borrowing his dad's razor when he was 7 years old and trying to shave his face.
Precious gift.
Yeah.
Wanting to already to be a grown up. And then when he did grow up, he had a rather colorful life. Did you research about his any of the women that he spent time with and what they might have said about Rudolph Valentino?
Yes. So he got this job dancing. He was in his early 20s, completely gorgeous. He had this kind of skinny waist, was wearing, you know, suits and like tie and beautiful. And the women flocked to him. Now, he was Italian, which, and this was 1913, there was a lot of discrimination against Italians, but women thought it was super sexy. And he would dance a tango with them, and some women were enamored with him. And he actually, there was one woman who was enamored with him, whose husband was having an affair with a taxi dancer woman, as well, and she ended up shooting her husband in the face 5 times and killing him. So that, which was like, it took a turn for the worse.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, he was super popular, but it was disreputable what he was doing. Dancing with women was not considered, and he also taught dance above Maxim's, private dance lessons, and that's where a lot of the sexual stuff went on, because anytime there were private dance lessons, it was just the dance instructor and the woman, and a lot of times they were having sex for money.
Yeah, yeah. So, and then he went on to silent films, and more women then swooned about him, because he portrayed somebody romantic and somebody who wanted female pleasure. He wanted women to have pleasure. Did you find that? I mean, I'm kind of guessing that, because the very best gigolos are all invested in a woman's pleasure.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And he was like the first pinup for women.
Oh,
women,
I love that.
Yeah, women swooned over him. They were obsessed with him. I mean, movies were a new thing. And we think about the male gaze in movies and how movies are filmed for male sexual pleasure. And so close-ups on women's breasts and butt. But Valentino, there were close-ups on his chest and his beautiful face. And it was almost the female gaze, even though it was male directors. Women like loved him, made him like the most popular actor. Their husbands were so upset about it. But he always carried this disreputable air. So like some people, I mean, he was called a gigolo in Hollywood, and people thought, do we want to work with that gigolo? And he also portrayed male dancers in movies. That was one of his things as well, because he was such a talented dancer.
Yes, yes, yes.
But yeah, he was, there was this idea, the look in his eyes, that he cared about women and that he would be the ultimate lover, the first Latin lover, and the ultimate, like, actually caring about women.
Caring about women. And women have been starved for that through the ages, with some exceptions, just starved for it. What else did you find? Because this book, The History of the Gigolo, is going to come out, perhaps you're going to have it published maybe by next year it'll be published?
Yeah, next year.
So, and you are a good researcher. I mean, your book Buzz is just filled with all your research citations, and we talked about that on the toward the last the 29th of December. But what else have you found? And I want to, of course, talk about my research about the Gai geishas in Japan.
Yes.
But I want to hear a little bit more about what else you've uncovered as you research your upcoming book, The History of the Gigolo.
Yeah, so what I've uncovered is kind of that gigolos have existed throughout history. They have never been as prominent as prostitutes for men. And this is because we live in a patriarchal culture, mm-hmm. where men's sexual pleasure is sanctioned, like it's allowed, like men are expected to want multiple partners, allowed to have it, allowed to seek sexual pleasure outside of marriage, and have been throughout history. Whereas women have actually, you know, either sometimes even been murdered, like honor killings, for seeking sexual pleasure outside of marriage.
Yes.
And that's an extreme example. And the non-extreme example was best case scenario, they were considered, you know, a complete outcast for doing that. And they, you know, if they were found to be having sexual relationships before marriage, they were a slut, they were all these things. So women have had such fewer opportunities. So the fact that even that gigolos have existed throughout history shows how strong women's pleasure is, that they are willing to risk their lives to get, like some women, to get this kind of sexual pleasure. So that was one of the like really interesting things I found. And like even before women were allowed to vote, I mean, they were paying to dance and have sex with Rudolph Valentino. And that's kind of amazing. Like talk about the power of women's sex drives. So that's one of the things I've really found. But you see, even with like, there are always fewer opportunities for women to pay for sex. And there's always been this argument, oh, women don't want to do that, which is not true. But I think it's because it's so threatening to men that a lot of these opportunities have been shut down throughout history.
With my my study in Japan, and this was in the early 90s, and I'm going to go into that in a little bit more, but so to tag on to what you just said, because we've known for a long time that women in Japan are famously subservient, and this was the official stamp of approval came in feudal times, and it was decided that the chief duty of a woman was to obey her husband. And it wasn't until the end of World War II that only men in Japanese society were permitted to wander away from the marital bed, usually into the company of the cultured geisha or into the arms of prostitutes. A married, unfaithful woman was sent to prison.
Mm, yeah.
I mean, talk about double standard.
Yeah, yes.
She was sent. So that's a little bit of the history in Japan. But certainly we have many, even current examples of women being, well, in some of, isn't in some Muslim societies,
yeah,
the woman brings dishonor on, even if she was raped. I mean, this is going a little bit afield from what our focus is, but women have had it rough when they might want to, not the rape part, but just having sex outside of the marriage.
Oh, absolutely. It's much harder for women to have sex outside of marriage. They're taking a huge risk.
Yeah.
They're taking a risk of death in some cases, divorce, losing their children. A lot of times a woman's adultery meant that, you know, she could lose her children. I mean, there's this huge risk and there's this huge double standard. But throughout history, there have been these gigolos who have existed. So we have like Valentino in the 1920s, who's the main, who's one of the most interesting characters. And then we have Chippendales in the 1970s. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
I'm not only familiar, but I saw them perform once many years ago.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, they are very, very sexy. And I saw them with a whole bunch of other women in Las Vegas years ago.
Yes.
And they would come and mingle with the women who were just, I mean, going, oh, really? Oh, wow. And women reporting that their panties are getting wet.
Yes. Yes. Oh, my God. Chippendales are amazing. And they were started in 1979 in California. Yeah. And so they were one of the first male strippers for women. Mm-hmm. And they were started by this Indian immigrant, Soman Banerjee or Steve Banerjee. And they became wildly popular. And to talk about the female gaze again, women, research shows that women get just as aroused by naked men, heterosexual women, as men get aroused, heterosexual men get aroused by naked women. So women are as visual as men. And some studies have shown they're more visual. And this is something that, like, you'll hear a lot, oh, women aren't visual, they're not interested in that. That science doesn't back that up. And even when Chippendales came out, a lot of people said, oh, you know, women don't want this, even though women were blocking. There were lines down the street to get in there. But how this fits into gigolos is kind of like the Rudolph Valentino thing. The Chippendales were male dancers who also had sex with women for a fee. That's a side of the Chippendales that people don't know. And
I did not know that.
And even today they're doing it, because I went and saw the show and talked to them, and it's very hush hush. But if you talk to the right guy and you ask the right questions, you can, you know, pay to have sex with a Chippendale. So that has been going on. And that was one of, so male strippers like became a thing in the 70s with Chippendales. There were other troupes that kind of like spun off of them. And this was another way that women had access to paid sex. So there's paid sex in the sense of the lap dance and Chippendales. When they started in the 70s, they had paid kissing as part of the show. Which is not extreme like sex, but then paid sex was a part of Chippendales as well. And so that was another way. And it's the same thing where like the dancing, there were these tango tees and tango pirates. These were known in culture in the 1920s. Women would go to a tango dance and it was socially acceptable to do it. And then on the down low, they were sleeping with them, with the tango dancers for money, and that wasn't socially acceptable. It's similar to Chippendales, where everyone knew about Chippendales. It was this big thing. Women could go and tell their husbands and joke, and a lot of them were also sleeping with them, which is kind of, there's an interesting parallel.
So I have a story to tell, and it took place in where you live, in Atlanta.
Oh.
And it was sometime around the mid-90s. I went to one of my conferences there. I think it was the Quad S Conference, Scientific Society for Study of Sexuality. And so a group of us, male and female sex therapists, sex educators, decided to see what was going on in Atlanta. So first we went to a female strip joint, and the women were, a lot of them were students. What's your main university there?
Georgia Tech is one of the big ones.
Well, that's where you teach. But there's another one. Hmm. They were anyway, many of them, I heard, the strippers, they were only wearing G-strings, and they were very sexy and doing strips. And the men who were watching them were so polite, and they put the little dollar bill into the string. Then we went of their little cover up there. And then we went to a male strip joint.
Oh.
And somebody told the group that there was a group of sex therapists. And I say that because what happened afterwards was very interesting. But let me tell you, the show that these guys did, and some of them were dressed like YMCA and policemen and firefighters and Indian chiefs. And they were really good dancers, and they were really sexy men, and they were really well built. The women in the audience, unlike the men in the female strip joint, were very misbehaved. They'd all get together, and there was all this energy and hooting and hollering, and just, it's like the women had to get together, and as a group, they could really express their sexual desire for these guys, their lust. And they gave each other permission in this group, but they were not well behaved. Afterwards, one of the better looking guys came and sat right next to me, and he definitely propositioned me. But first he wanted to know, you know, about my field. And yes, and I said, I'm a sex therapist. And he said, I'd sure like to spend some time with you. And I said, well, I thank you. I'm complimented. But I said, I just don't have an interest, and I'm married, and so on and so forth. I wasn't going to go there, but I said to him, I'm complimented by your interest. Because at that point in time, I was more than a middle-aged woman. But anyway, that's my story. Women really like to see, many women do, not all women. They like to see these strippers, men, and have their own fantasies and act in ways that they might have trouble acting with, say, their boring old husband of some 15 years or something. or even sometimes newly married women, they just like the excitement.
Yeah. Oh, go on.
And I'm just thinking about Wednesday Martin and her book, The Bored Sex. And she points out that women more than men tend to feel stultified by long-term exclusivity, despite having been taught that they were designed for it. It's really true. We've always been taught as women that we're designed for monogamy, and in her research, she found it was just not true that women, that she says that, well, of course, we talk about the conundrum biologists call habituation to a stimulus, and she points out that men can manage wanting what they already have while women struggle with it. And that long-term relationships are especially hard on female desire. And I bet you have encountered that too in your readings, your research.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's almost like women have been gaslit into thinking they're naturally monogamous because it benefits patriarchal culture.
Uh-huh.
Because if women think that they, you know, any desires outside of marriage or outside of monogamy are, you know, odd and weird and unnatural and unnormal, then, you know, they shut them down and they don't give themselves permission to experience them. And so it goes back to the thing about, you know, women in groups needing that permission at a strip club. I've seen that over and over again, where men can go to a strip club by themselves. They don't even need to go with one friend. They feel that it's okay.
They feel entitled.
Entitled. That's a better way of saying it. Yeah, they feel entitled to do it. They feel it's the male privilege thing. And where women have to, I've noticed when I went to like 5 different strip clubs when I went on a girls' trip in Vegas, and I noticed that nearly every club, the MC would say, okay, ladies, give yourself permission to celebrate. It's your, you know, I know some of you are here to celebrate marriage or upcoming wedding or divorce or a 30th birthday party. And so it was always that women needed permission. They needed an event to go where any day of the week a man would go and he doesn't need permission. And I found that very surprising to me.
Yeah. It fits into how, what we've been learning in our culture. And So let's talk a little bit about my research in Japan, which I'm going to share with you. And I've sent you the paper that I wrote, and it was later published in Norway in 1992. I've sent that to you, but I'm going to send you another, because I found some more that I wrote about that. This is research I did in 1992, and I made several trips to Japan to do this. And what I found from this Professor Ishikawa, he was my Tokyo friend and colleague, he really encouraged me to do the research, because this population of the guy geishas, the male hosts, otherwise known as swallows, had never been studied. Now, again, this is the early 90s, and you and I found a study that was done more recently in Japan, and I'd like to find out a little bit more about that one. But the Japanese tend to be a little more casual about sexuality. They consider sex just one of life's functions, like eating and sleeping. And of course, there are fewer Judeo-Christian overlays, which often produce guilt and shame in our society. So, but, you know, my grandmother, who was born in 1888, she and her parents and her sisters made a trip around the world before World War I. And they were in Japan, and my grandmother was a very Victorian young lady. She and her sisters, her three sisters, all were raised to be very proper Victorian young ladies. So they asked in the hotel for a private bath, and the Japanese bellboy didn't understand private. He looked it up in his dictionary and said, "Also private bath." And he laughed and laughed and laughed. This is before World War I. So to get to the private bath, my grandmother and her sisters, all young ladies, all high school, college age, had to walk through the big public bath, which was about 5 feet above the ground, big tub, men and women in there nude. Mm-hmm. So they kept their eyes straight ahead, because they were kind of embarrassed. And then they went to a smaller room with a smaller bath, and they were just about to take off their robes, and they heard all this giggling. And in the little transit window above the door that they came in, were three little Japanese faces looking down, because they were so curious. What's so funny about these American women that they can't join us in the public tub? So they put a towel up over the transit. But that's just one example of the Japanese experimenting with different types of mythology, and there was pagan art, and so there was kind of an earthiness among the Japanese as we look at them. So anyway, I went to this Club I. Club I stands for love, AI. And I went with Yoshi, who was my friend and translator. She was a woman living in Tokyo. And so I couldn't have done it without her. But we picked out about five hosts. If you're a woman coming into the club, I was the first Caucasian woman in the club. Then they learned that I was also a sex therapist. So they were fascinated by me. But we sat with these Japanese hosts, and we learned about the various many possibilities that occur. And women who come to the club, like you mentioned earlier, they're high class women. They couldn't afford it otherwise. Some women would spend as much as $5,000. I don't know what it would be in yen, but a night. And they would dance with these guys, and the guys would give provide conversation, would listen to them and dance with them. And then if a little more interest, the woman might come back several times with several hosts at her table, and then she might pick one, and he might become her new swallow. And a swallow goes from one warm climate to the next. And in this case, from one warm woman to the next. So if he became her swallow, this usually would be after he would go with her. This was in the Kabukicho, the sex district of Tokyo. So he would go with her to one of the love hotels. And those can be rented by the hour or 2 hours, or they're very expensive and very fancy and very fanciful, these love hotels. So then if there was a real connection, they really did have the chemistry, she'd often pick him to be her new swallow. She'd put him up in an apartment. She'd buy him new clothes, pay off his debts if necessary. But then in some cases, he became her exclusive sexual property. So this was the arrangement. I wanted to just share, because this will help us segue into women wanting buying sex because they want pleasure for its own sake. The female customers in Club I were often professionals, doctors, lawyers, or very wealthy women who didn't want to have a real affair. Well, that happens more in the United States. In Japan, it just was having sex for its own sake appealed to these women, because some of these women did not want to have, some of the professional women that I actually talked to did not want to have a Japanese husband. They'd heard stories about how they often, there were just three words when they'd come home, the Japanese husband would come home: food, massage, bath. Just three words, no conversation.
Oh my God.
So, but among the female customers, there were ladies from Soapland, and they'd come in after midnight. And these ladies from the Soapland were fed up with their male customers, and they wanted to be pampered instead. So it was a real switch. In Soapland, the ladies put their men on plastic sheets or beds, and they rubbed them in fancy ways with soap and water. And of course, most soap jobs also included blowjobs. And I later asked these hosts, because I had interviews with them, and I gave them questionnaires that were translated into Japanese, and it was a thorough research. But I asked the host if these women were better lovers, and they responded yes, because they said they are, after all, trained to please men, and that's their pleasure too. But the host reported that these women were more uninhibited and expert in certain techniques. And they went on to explain that if lovemaking takes place with one of these ladies, they do it only as a man, never as a host for hire. The main issue here, the main message here, is that the Soapland ladies enjoyed sex for sex's sake, especially when they were being given pleasure instead of having to give it. So that switched it up. So I found my research in Japan absolutely fascinating. And I remember returning and telling some of my friends about it, and they said, where are our swallows? Where can we find this? And some of these friends were fancy friends, you know, like some of my junior league friends. they were well too. So they wanted their own swallows, but that was the 90s, and we've come a long ways. And
Yeah.
So talk about a little bit more about women paying for sex or whatever you want to talk about.
Yeah. But no, the women paying for sex thing. So the Japanese thing is still going on to this day, as you know, as we discussed before.
Yeah.
And the men, they're paying for sex. The host clubs, they've been affected by coronavirus. So a lot of them have had to shut down, just like everything. And actually, the Japanese government blamed host clubs and hostess clubs for the spread of coronavirus, which goes into the history of how sex workers are always being blamed for diseases, whether they're at fault or not. They're an easy scapegoat. Yeah, but women, so I've talked to women who've paid for sex today. So I've talked to, there are a number of, if for women, I don't know if any of your listeners want to buy sex, it's illegal. So I can't legally encourage it. In the US, it's illegal to pay for sex.
Wait a minute, except in Nevada.
Except in Nevada. But the interesting thing about Nevada is there aren't any, there are two counties in Nevada where it's legal. They tried in the 90s, they tried, in the early 2000s, actually, sorry, not the 90s, they tried to have male escorts for women. There's a guy named Why Not, which is like such a stupid name for male escort. and they failed. And I want to study the reason for why they failed. I don't know at the time. So getting legal paid sex, again, it's the double standard. Men can go to Nevada and pay for sex with a woman. Legally in this country, into the certain counties, a heterosexual woman can't find a man in Nevada because they don't exist, like paid male escorts for women that are legal. But Heidi Fleiss, the madam, are you familiar with her?
Oh, sure.
Okay. She, in the early 2000s, developed plans to create what she called a stud farm in Nevada. For women, it would be a brothel for women full of men and male escorts. And she had all this planning for it. And then the whole thing fizzled out, never came to fruition. But I think her idea is wonderful. I think it could work. And I hope someone actually creates that. But as far as the women paying for sex now, I've talked to some female clients. One client I talked to, she and her husband she's Australian, and she and her husband had not had sex for over a year. She loved him, she said. They had a good relationship, like aside from the sex part, they were best friends, that whole type of thing that you've probably seen in your therapy.
Sure.
And so she said, I don't want to have an affair because I don't want to screw up my marriage and have this emotional relationship. So I'm going to hire an escort.
Yeah. And many women rationalize it that way.
Exactly. And in Australia, in most states in Australia, it's legal.
Uh-huh.
So this is why today in Australia, women are buying sex more than they are in the US, because women are more risk averse. They're scared of being arrested. They don't want to break the law. So even with male escorts in the US, women are like, I don't want to break the law for my sexual pleasure. Where men are willing to. Men are willing to take that risk. Women aren't. So in Australia, there are a lot of gigolos. There are women doing it. So anyway, so she didn't tell her husband, but she booked an escort, had sex with him, had an amazing experience. And then admitted to her husband and thought, like a few weeks later, and thought this would be the end of the relationship. Well, he said, I completely understand. I have been wanting to explore other things as well. So he began, you know, having relationships, not with escorts, but with women. And she would go see this male escort, and he would go parasailing sometimes while she was seeing the male escort. But it's worked. They've stayed together. And sometimes they play together at play parties and swinger type parties. Sometimes she goes to see her escort. But they, you know, they have a deal where they can't be in these super emotional relationships with other people. Like, it's about more, I wouldn't say it's more about sex, but good sex has emotion as well. But it's not about like a real relationship.
Interesting. And let's talk about the, it was a small study, 21 Australian women aged 18 to 69 explained why they paid for sex. And I think this is interesting. For therapy, either medical, maybe trauma issues. For therapy, to learn new types of sex play experiences, explore their own sexual orientation. Sometimes they want to experience having sex with another woman. And for intimacy, touch and affirmation. And but the main reason was pleasure, their own pleasure, not the man's.
Yes.
I hired you, and so I have the right to have the pleasure that I want to have. And, right? And,
Yeah.
I was looking to quote an escort, because I've got that. Oh, yes, here. One of the questions that I asked an escort a long time ago was, do you recall hearing about the worst thing that you had to contend with? And it was humiliation. You do this, you do that, I'm paying you. But that didn't happen very often, where you had a woman who was, you do this. The other reasons that women might pay, boring and quick. Go away, I just want to sleep. But also, when you pay for sex, they don't talk. And, you know, we have a sex industry because we need and want one.
Yeah.
And understanding the people in this huge industry is not helped by either idealizing or condemning them.
Yeah. Absolutely. And what is interesting, and like you talk about like women wanting sexual pleasure, needing that, and women feel uncomfortable asking for it. That's what I found in interviewing these clients of male escorts. They felt uncomfortable, like they had been in this relationship for 20 years and maybe there was a technique their husband or partner did that they didn't like. And they felt uncomfortable at this point bringing it up. So it was easier for them to, instead of trying to fix the sex life with their husband and risk getting in fights and making him feel insecure, to go pay someone, tell them exactly what they want and be able to assert themselves without, you know, worrying about hurting their feelings. They felt more comfortable asserting their sexual needs when they were paying for it because they felt that they didn't have permission. We talk about permission with strippers and you know, sexual pleasure. They felt they didn't have permission. And another important thing that they said was, when they were in having sex with their partner, their non-paid partner, they would feel guilty taking too long to orgasm. So they would say if he was going down on her for 15 minutes, she hadn't had an orgasm, she felt guilty, she would just ask him to stop because she felt it was the women needing to please the man thing. She thought, okay, I have to give him an orgasm. That's my job as a wife. My orgasm, second best. And I, you know, don't want to put my husband through this. So that was another reason, is because women don't feel like they deserve pleasure in the way that a man feels this right for pleasure. And so it's sometimes easier for them to find someone whose job it is to give them pleasure, to ask for it in that situation. And some of the male escorts I spoke to had orgasm money back guarantees.
I love it.
And the one guy who had that, he said he's been doing it for 15 years. Three women have asked for it and he's given it to them.
That is wonderful. Well, yes, of course, the big problem for the average woman is now if she's in charge with and buying this sexual relationship, she can assert herself more and also maybe just within that, knowing that the man is going to go down on her for as long as it takes and that he likes it, because he probably tells her that. I love going down on you. I like the sensations. I like the smell. I love everything. And a good gigolo knows his way around a woman's body. He knows her anatomy. He knows her G-spot. He knows, and he asks her, You know, this is what we miss. Many people miss a lot in sexual communication. What do you want? What do you need? Tell me.
Yeah.
And so maybe saying that to a relative stranger is easier than with your longtime partner. Or I just hope to God women are not faking orgasms with their regular partners, because that's such a bad thing to do, in that it's miscommunication. He thinks he's giving you pleasure and he's not, and you're faking it, and it's like a lie. So that's not good.
No, it's still happening. I know, I've talked to friends who fake orgasms, and it's still, and I'm like, don't do that, because you're right. It's giving people the wrong information. So they'll keep doing that thing that isn't giving you an orgasm.
Yeah, right. That isn't.
Yeah. So it's a real problem. But I think that, you know, male escorts for women, I mean, I'm hopeful that this can become more popular, but I do think it takes the decriminalization of sex work for women to be comfortable with it. I really strongly believe that.
Yes. I think you made a good point a few minutes ago when you said, women in America tend to be much more risk adverse.
Yeah.
And of course the women in Australia, since it's legal there, they didn't have to worry about that. But of course, you know, the women who do take advantage and can afford to hire a gigolo, part of the sexual excitement, I'm sure, has to do with the fact that it's taboo. I'm doing a naughty thing here.
Oh,
and this is exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a taboo nature, and like this idea, like also role reversal, like taking control, and I'm the one in charge. And they do, you know, you mentioned sexual communication. A lot of the gigolos I talk to, they will sit down with their clients and say, here's, you know, the kind of things I can do. Tell me what do you want me to do? What are your erogenous zones? What are your don't touch zones? What are your do touch zones? What's traumatic? And these are the kind of conversations we should be having with every sexual partner. But you know, I've talked to women who say being with a gigolo and having that conversation has helped bring that information to non-paid partners and their, you know, husbands or whatever, which I think is awesome.
It is. And my book, Love in the Time of Corona, Advice from a Sex Therapist for Couples in Quarantine, has a very popular sex menu. And the sex menu is in the first chapter, Getting to Know Your Partner Better, where I have about 44 different sexual activities, going from very vanilla sex into more kinky sex. And so the couple gets to say, and by the way, it's a free download on my advice website, DearDrDiana.com, the sex menu. So they get to say yes, no, maybe, giver, receiver, and then it gets them talking. And so many, this has helped, I know this from couples I'm seeing currently. It really, really helps to get them talking about. So a gigolo who says, what are your good touch zones? And getting this all up front, this should be just standard fare for all couples who want to be sexual together.
Your best
way of having great sex is to talk about it, because if you don't say what you want and need and desire, it's like going on a treasure hunt without any clues.
Yeah, exactly. And I know, like, that your sex menu, because I wrote the article for Glamour about love during COVID times, and what was basically couples counseling during COVID times.
Yeah.
And one of your clients who I interviewed talked about how useful the sex menu was for them.
Yes. And I'm going to put that link up in my show notes too, because thank you again for interviewing me and highlighting my book. And then you interviewed one of my couples. They agreed to do it with, of course, different names. The sex menu is, but let's go back to these gigolos. I think these are enlightened men. I was also thinking, to go back to Rudolph Valentino.
Yeah.
Italian men have always had the reputation of being really great lovers. And I read this somewhere, and I did spend a summer in Italy, and I had an Italian stallion lover in my 20s. And he didn't speak much English, and I didn't speak much Italian, but I learned for the first time in my young life at that point, 25 or so, that I didn't necessarily have to speak fluent Italian to have great sex. And that, but also that the man didn't have to be, we didn't have to have an intellectual, I'm not an intellectual, but a really highly intelligent connection in terms of discussions that I could really just enjoy. But the thing I learned is Italian men talk to other Italian men about relationships and about sexual skills. And men in the US, no, they're usually bragging. They're not really talking about sexual skills. So that's a difference.
Yeah, no, the Italian, the Latin, and it's so awesome that you had this Italian lover. You spoke the language of love or whatever. But Italian men have a well-deserved reputation, I think, for really pleasing a woman. I mean, Valentino, from when he was, I just found this out last night while doing research. When he was 14 or 15, he lost his virginity to prostitutes, actually, in Italy, and he got syphilis from it. And this was, and it couldn't really be cured at the time. And this may have affected his relationships with women throughout his life. But regardless of the syphilis thing, he was popular with women as a young teenager. I mean, they would flock to him, and he had some sort of way. He always loved older women too. So, I mean, when he was 15, it was an 18-year-old woman or whatever. And then when he got older, it was even bigger age difference, but he was attracted to that. He was very close to his mother.
Interesting. I'm going to look up Rudolph Valentino. You're going to put this in your book too.
Yeah.
He was close to his mother. Yeah, go on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And although we're coming close to the end, and I do want to talk just a little bit about sex and the older woman in general.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I was just going to say, he was always, was able to attract these women. And there's another famous Italian lover who is considered a gigolo, Porfirio Rubirosa.
Oh, yes.
You know him.
Oh, well, I know of him.
Yeah, I know you don't know him personally, but he was
known to be extremely well endowed.
Exactly. And the pepper grinders in Italy were called Ruby Rosas.
Right. I remember that.
Yeah. And he married Doris Day, I believe. He would always marry women for money, but he was another Italian lover who was famous for his sexual prowess. So, yeah.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about sex and the older woman, and just before we run out of time.
Yeah.
And of course, I'm going to have you back because you're really fun to talk to and you're a wealth of information. We have. So I want to talk about sex and the older woman. I've been interested in this for years, and now I'm there and I'm an older woman having great sex, and I'm so glad. Because my husband and I know how to do it. But I think that for some older people, there's the nearness of death. And sex is a way of convincing yourself that you're still alive. You know, that there are some older men who will go after a younger woman because they wanted the reassurance that they were still part of the dance of life. They wanted proof that the angel of death was not hovering too near. And they thought that, and I think sometimes they think that if they are with a very young woman, that youth might protect them. But sex is very profound drive, and we can still feel it, can fill us with hope, it can enliven the mind and the senses. You know, I'm all for remaining sexual right on through your life, and to do that, you have to keep your health. And that's so important. But I'm, yeah, sex is fabulous. And I'm really glad you're writing this book on the male escort. And this, it's, we need to decriminalize sex, and it can be of so much benefit to our health and to everything.
Yeah.
What thing would you like to leave the audience with before we end here?
Well, since you were talking about sex and older people and stuff like that, what I would like to leave with is the oldest customers of male escorts are in that I've heard of are in their 80s. And one male escort told me when he was working in the 1980s, actually, he had a client in her who was 80 years old who had never had a man go down on her.
Yeah.
And she, yep. And she was a widow. And she, and he actually was 17 and underage, which I don't know if you know. We'll pretend that she didn't know that. Maybe she didn't. And she had her husband had, she loved him so much, but he'd never done this. And he went down on her and she had an orgasm and she said it was the most wonderful thing. And it brought her a huge amount of joy. And so if for older people going to male escorts, if they do, they can experience new sexual things that maybe they hadn't in their partner, and talk about that feeling that you're alive. Like a new sexual experience is one of the best ways to get that feeling. And everyone during coronavirus sees death, you know, a lot closer, and everyone kind of needs that. Yeah.
That's the pandemic sex.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I can personally say I'm much more aware of my mortality during this pandemic. And I'm so fortunate to have a loving, supportive, sexy husband.
Yeah.
And we'll do this again. And I'm so glad that you came back to the program, Hallie Lieberman. Thank you so much. And I think that we're going to hear the music here shortly. otherwise, I can fill in, of course. There's the music.
Well, thank you for having me. It was fantastic.
You're welcome, Hallie. It's wonderful to have you. We'll be in touch.
Okay, great.
Bye, everybody. Feel alive.
E se ti perderai nel labirinto di un amaro autore.